Welcome to Political Rewind, another day where we have too little time and too much to talk about. We are eventually going to figure out some way to steal time away from the shows on either side of us, because we could easily go 3 hours with all the political news these days. Don't you agree, Jim Galloway, political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution?
I do, Mr. Nigut. How are you feeling? How's your health care? How are your premiums?
I am so fortunate. I'm blessed, I think, Senator Nan Orrick, Democrat, to be a member, part of a group plan. And right now, I'm not as worried about all this as many people are. We'll talk about that, though.
Absolutely.
Leo Smith is here, too. He is a former minority engagement director for the Georgia Republican Party. He's no longer with the Georgia Republican Party, Galloway.
He's striking out on his own.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah. Go ahead.
He is a state Senate candidate running for Hunter Hill's seat.
You know, we just learned this as you came in, because you haven't told anybody about it. But you've said you're going to go after that seat. Is that right, Leo?
That's correct. I mean, you know, my job as a grassroots person was to make sure I created an ecosystem where we got leaders to develop. And no leader had jumped in early. And I said, well, it looked like I might have to do it myself. And so here I am.
All right. And joining us from Washington, Washington reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Tamar Hallerman. How are you, Tamar?
Bill, what happened to my new theme music?
Your new theme music?
For the show. I thought we were testing them out. I thought the decisions would be made.
You know, I got to tell you, you know what? Sometimes we are so disorganized on this show, Tamar. We did say we were going to pick new theme music, and we had a number of different samples, and then, I don't know, it just got lost in the shuffle. I apologize, Tamar.
I'm very disappointed.
are you up on the Hill in your tiny little cubicle office?
Yes, sir. But today I'm in a tiny little phone booth, one of the old relics of the Senate.
Oh, yeah, exactly. All right. Well, Tamar, I'm actually going to go to you first, because we now are about... I'm sorry. Lisa Clark is telling me something that I don't see. I said Nan Orrick. I said Leo Smith. I said Jim Galloway and Tamar Hallerman. Lisa didn't think I introduced you, Nan.
Well, I remember it.
Good.
So that's a good sign.
Tamar, let's start with the health care bill and then get everybody in the mix. If I can, let me just say, and then you correct me if I'm wrong. We saw the new bill come out yesterday, and it's an attempt to try to give everybody a little something. Just as a couple of examples of that, to try to appease the conservatives, the McConnell's folks have included what's been called the Cruz Amendment, which would allow insurers, as long as they offer a package that meets the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, they can offer also a kind of insurance light, which has a smaller, lighter package of coverage, might cut out maternity care, might cut out emergency room care, whatever.
Might cut out cancer.
Could be cancer treatment. So that's an attempt to appease the conservative, the real right-wingers who have been opposed to the bill. And on the other side, the moderates, they've decided they will restore what were tax cuts, 3.8% tax on investments for people earning something like $200,000, $250,000, in an attempt to say, well, we're not going to do a giveaway to the rich and cut insurance for the poor. Is that kind of a sort of basic way to look at this?
Absolutely. As you remember, one of the reasons why the first iteration of the bill did not take off was because McConnell was facing opposition from both the right and the center. So he is trying to win over both sides.
And how do you see that going up there today as you've wandered the halls of the Senate?
Well, I mean, it really, you know, he's on the edge right now. He has two Republicans, Susan Collins, a moderate from Maine, and Rand Paul, a libertarian from Kentucky, who kind of leans more on the conservative side, who said they're definite no's. He cannot lose anybody else after those two, or else the thing is dead. So they are trying so hard to hold on to people over the weekend. But the problem is everybody flew home yesterday. They're going home. They're talking to constituents. They're talking to their governors. There's a ton of pressure on both sides here.
Now, they had our senators, Isaacson and Perdue, they were able to get a little provision in there to boost the boost Medicaid payments to states that haven't the 19 states that haven't expanded Medicaid. I think about an extra $250 million a year that would go to charity hospitals and such.
Well, the real question, what are they doing around Medicaid? I mean,
the caps are still there.
That's right. That's huge. In other words, using a block grant instead of having it be available to all that are eligible for it.
Well, the revised bill is what, $70 billion in additional funds that the states could divvy up for Medicaid?
Well, that means nothing if you have a waiting list for Medicaid. The elderly, the sick, the destitute, children.
Tell me, how important are governors in this play? I mean, we've had Nathan Deal say that he just wants a fair deal. He wants Georgia to get the same deal that Ohio gets. But we've also had...
Because Ohio expanded Medicaid under the ACA.
That's right.
And Georgia didn't.
And we did not. You have John Kasich saying it's still a bad deal. He's the governor of Ohio. How big an influence do they have over what happens next?
Sure. I mean, so Nathan Deal, as you mentioned, was a huge player behind the scenes here. He was talking with Isaacson and Perdue all along, helping them kind of negotiate, here's what we need to see in this bill. They're especially important, these governors, as a lot of these senators who are still undecided go home this weekend and try and figure out what they want to do. Rob Portman in Ohio, he's talking, I'm sure, to John Kasich every day to try and figure out what to do. And as you mentioned, Kasich came out against the bill. I'm also looking at Dean Heller in Nevada.
Yes.
He's going to be huge. Yeah. And he, I believe, doesn't he have a Democratic governor?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he has a constituency that's been speaking to him loud and clear, and he has a contested race that he's...
Exactly. Facing. And that was a state that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So in theory, you know, they would be very much impacted by shifting this bill.
So let me pick up a couple of loose threads before we go too far down the road. One of them is Leo made a comment that the new bill has something like $70 billion that if Medicaid becomes a block grant for the states, what they've done to offset the problems that could create in terms of giving people enough insurance is the states will be able to tap into a fund for people who have emergency medical needs. That's the way they're trying to placate the moderates like Susan Collins. It's really questionable whether that's going to work or not, I think. But before we even discuss that, Tamara, Jim Galloway mentioned, and I think you should expand on it a bit, Isaacson and Perdue did work to get this amendment into the bill that will help states without expanded Medicaid. And you point out in your piece on this that you believe that this, even though they haven't declared themselves, that if you accept something like that, if you work hard and get it, you're probably going to be a yes vote, right?
It's viewed as a big no-no to work so hard to get an add-on to the bill and then vote against the underlying bill. I mean, it's done, but it's very much frowned upon. So their votes have never been in doubt here.
Well, what's the answer? What's the answer? Well, I would agree with you.
The big question here, then, is the Cruz thing, the Cruz amendment that allows insurance companies to offer whatever kind of policy they want. And that's one of those policies. It looks like it would become one of those policies where a buyer is going to have to guess as to what disease he's going to get, what accident is going to befall him. And that's where the Georgia Hospital Associations and all the big medical institutions say that's where this falls down.
That's right.
Because you create two different insurance pools. And only one of them is going to be for pre-existing conditions.
Leo, another issue, I turn to you as the Republican in the room, another issue that many people have, including some of the big health associations, as Jim started to point out, with selective coverage like that, is that this is why most healthcare experts have said for a long time, you've got to have a mandate. If you start offering people cheap insurance policies, there isn't enough money, the other side argues, to pay for people who have conditions where they really need coverage. And so that's been a real problem. If you take away the individual mandate and you give people the chance to buy cheap insurance, the pool of available money is reduced dramatically.
In theory, you can understand that argument, but the other side of that argument is that by giving people who are not low income choices that have higher premiums and have another type of tax and so to speak, that you are paying for that. You're paying into the system because you're giving buyers choices, and some buyers pay more for their choice than other buyers.
You know, we have to be clear that this is about people's lives, people's health status, and people's opportunity to heal and get well versus go down the tubes with a health challenge. But it's also about our infrastructure for our health system. The hospitals have been a very profoundly loud voice across the country. We're having rural hospitals dropping like flies, and when people are uninsured or underinsured, they present at the hospital in health crisis, and there's no money to pay for that service, so the hospitals eat it. And it's not been working, and it will worsen under this situation. That's why you hear such a weigh-in from the hospitals on this.
Sure.
And this is about our infrastructure of providing health services.
It's infrastructure, and it's also the providers, the insurers. I mean, the insurers also want to stay in business, and even, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield is still raising their premium prices as we speak.
They will do that if they're not regulated by government.
You know, Tamar, I want to pick up on your comment about Isaacson Purdue. It's bad form if you push for something, get it in the bill, and then vote against it. The Wall Street Journal had a really interesting editorial this morning. The headline was Obamacare Moment of Truth. And the point of the editorial, I'm going to read just a couple of lines of it in a second, but the point of the editorial essentially was the journal's take is that the McConnell folks moved the bill to the left to placate moderate Republicans. I find that an interesting a way of looking at the bill, but that's the way the journal portrayed it this morning. But then complains that moderates still, like a Susan Collins, still are not jumping on board. But let me read this to you and get your response first, Tamar. In the new bill, the GOP's economic growth wing made a major and bitter concession by retaining the 3.8% surcharge on investment income. This political capitulation doesn't even phase out the tax. It's in there. That tax remains. Repealing this millstone on investment and rising wages has allegedly been a Republican goal for years, and the Senate voted to do so as recently as 2015. And the Journal says that this is worrisome because it means Republicans are abandoning core principles to get the moderates on board. What's your reaction to that, Tamar?
I mean, it's certainly a tactic for all of these moderates who are wavering. These people like Dean Heller, these people like Rob Portman, who are clearly terrified and going home and trying to figure out what they want. Because if one more of them jumps, then that means 10 more of them jump. So I that's what I see this as, a way to pressure them to back the bill.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, the thing is, you've got all these Republican senators out there who are vulnerable in a general election to Democrats, and they are going to be faced with a campaign that says you cut taxes for the wealthy, and by doing so you cut health insurance for 22 million Americans over 10 years.
Right.
And that's not a line that you want to face in November.
Let's listen to, we've mentioned Susan Collins a couple times. She, as Tamar pointed out, is one of the definite no votes at this point. She has an interesting take right now. She's been one of those who's been worried about Medicaid, but she also has another concern that she expressed pretty clearly when she saw the new bill.
It does not make sense to do a major rewrite of a vital entitlement program without having any hearings or consideration of the implications. So that's something that is a major reason that I find myself unable to support the bill.
It's been a complaint all along, Nan, Leo. Yes?
Absolutely. And you remember Claire McCaskill, Senator from, I believe, Missouri, who confronted the chair about the writing the bill in the dark and not having any hearings at all and no opportunity to make amendments or to have a public debate. That's exactly what's wrong with it. And there's going to be they will reap a whirlwind. The last bill that the GOP trotted out had, what did it have, 17% approval rate?
Something like that.
Yeah, yep. Down below 20%.
Sure.
Those are killer numbers, and it's because you're messing with people's health care in profound ways, and you're seeking to take away a coverage that's been in place.
Well, I think this is still a fresh debate. I mean, I know it seems like it shouldn't be anymore, but when you have a majority in Congress, meaning you have more numbers, you have more people to share this idea. We've gone beyond the repeal Obamacare, replace Obamacare rhetoric, yeah? And now we actually have to create some legislation that is useful for governance. This is still a fresh debate.
But I'll tell you what, the lack of hearings and the lack of a public process, what that does is it makes the Congressional Budget Office scoring so important in this process. It's supposed to happen no later than Monday. It'll probably come out sometime this weekend. But basically, you're giving this one congressional entity kind of the true power to say whether this bill fails or not just by the way it characterizes
it. Yeah, it'll be fascinating to see what that CBO score shows.
Yes.
Tamar, Ted Cruz has been one of the loud voices opposed to previous iterations of the bill. Let's listen to what he said about the new bill, and then let me pose a question to you.
The bill today reflects the input from senators across the spectrum. It's not the ideal bill I'd like to pass. I suspect there may not be a single senator for whom it's the ideal bill they'd like to pass.
Okay, Ted Cruz. So here's the question, I think, Tamar. Do you think it's possible that where we're headed with this bill is going to be something like what the House faced first time around? Clearly, the House could not get the votes to pass the bill. By the second time they brought it up, Republicans had been persuaded. They've been fighting to repeal Obamacare. They've been telling their constituents for 7-8 years they were going to do it. And so despite the fact that a lot of Republicans didn't like the measure as much as they might want to, they passed it. Do you think we're headed for a similar situation here when you've got a Ted Cruz saying, I'm not crazy about the bill, but we got to do something?
You know, it's a jump ball at this point. Everybody wanted to declare the House bill completely dead the first time it failed. And then look, you saw conservative Republicans and you saw moderate Republicans get together outside of leadership and kind of craft their own agreement. That's certainly possible here in the Senate.
We've got a new dynamic, though, and that is Donald Trump's behaviors since that bill was passed, and he touted it in the Rose Garden, then went to the Senate and said that bill was mean and do something different. And all of the ethics issues, all that has happened since that House vote, who in the Senate is going to listen to Donald Trump try to influence them?
And there's another factor as well. The districts that these members, that the 435 members represent, are rather settled things. Maybe a good 20% are competitive. Your states are another matter. You can't gerrymander states, and so I think the hardline party position is a lot more difficult to carry in the Senate.
Yes, all right. But at the same time, I think this is a campaign promise that they've run on for years. I think a lot of it, when it comes down to it, keeping a campaign promise a core issue versus all the other reasons why you wouldn't want to do it, I think it's strong for them to want to sign on to this. They don't want to be the moderate who killed Obamacare repeal.
All right. So here's where we stand on this before we take our first break. And you can correct me if I've got this wrong tomorrow, but I think I'm right. McConnell is now pleading with his members to allow this to go to the floor for debate. That's the first vote, the procedural vote. And he is urging them to please at least give them the opportunity to put it on the floor and have a debate that could start as early as I suspect. The procedural vote could come midweek next week, I think.
Tuesday.
Okay, thank you. But he's not even there yet, is he?
He's not. I mean, he's right at the edge of a pin right now. He cannot afford to lose any more votes to even open debate. So we'll see what happens over the weekend.
All right. We're going to take a break right now. We got some tweets in. You tweet us at PoliticsGPB. A lot of you already have. We'll get to that and a lot more when we come back.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Thank you for choosing Georgia Public Broadcasting. We're an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, nationally recognized as a leader in innovative programs that help students earn their degrees. I'm Ellen Reinhart.
We're back on Political Rewind. Jim Galloway is here in the studio. Tamar Hallerman from the AJC Washington office is in Washington. Democratic Senator Nan Orrick is with us, and Republican Leo Smith, too. A couple quick notes. First of all, I don't want to let the show go by without saying we're very excited, Galloway. On Monday, we're going to be joined live on our 2 o'clock show by Senator Sam Nunn, former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, who has an awful lot to talk about right now.
Russia being one of them.
Russia being one of them. Absolutely. North Korea and their nuclear program and how he feels about that. It's going to be great to have Senator Nunn live on the show, so we hope
senior
you'll
statesman.
All...
Senior statesman, yeah.
A senior statesman. Thank you, Senator. A couple of tweets right now. We had Thought Crime tweeted, they say millions will die if Obamacare is repealed. I'd like to know how many millions died without Obamacare. We need a reference point. In other words, before there was any form of government health care. I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's worth looking
well,
into.
Well, we've had a form of government health care since the 60s when we put in Medicaid and Medicare.
Right, right. Yeah. Ted Barfield, if paying the health care for poor and those with pre-existing conditions is a function of government, we need to do it via taxation and transfer payments. And you know, Jim, before we completely get off the subject, this is, as this debate goes on, we are hearing the voices of real conservatives who are saying, this is
single
government
payer.
Should only. Well, there's on that side single payer, and on the other side, people saying government has overstepped, Leo, in deciding that government needs to pay all the health care costs for many people. It should be reserved for those who only need it most urgently. That's an interesting argument that I don't think is going to survive these days, is it?
I'm not sure it's going to survive, but it's a healthy one to have because it does, one, address the issue of statism and too big government interfering with the lives of people and forcing people to pay taxes when they're not benefiting from the services. But at the same time, it shows some compassion for those who are most needy.
You don't think people are benefiting from having everybody insured and investing in preventive care that is effective and affordable as opposed to dealing with people when they crash and burn because they didn't have blood pressure pills, so they're in our emergency rooms with strokes?
People are benefiting by everyone being healthy.
Right.
But just because you're insured doesn't make you healthy.
All right. Let's if we can, move on. Tomorrow we got a visit down here on Wednesday. We didn't get a chance to talk about it on the show then, from Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, who came to town to tell us that he thinks one of the most important decisions he's going to make early in his tenure up there, and certainly the most controversial, is rolling back the rules that the Obama administration put in place regarding nutrition and school lunches. And it's caused a stir all in Washington, too, hasn't it?
Exactly. He went toe-to-toe with former First Lady Michelle Obama within his first week there.
Jim.
And it's in Atlanta. His point was that look, if you've got to serve kids something they're going to eat. If they're not going to eat, it doesn't matter how healthy it is.
And do we have?
Well, that's a myth. That's a myth that kids aren't eating healthy food. I've got a great school right over in my district, Maynard Jackson High School. They are growing food on the rooftop. They are serving healthy meals. They're participating in a farm to school produce, Georgia produce. Purdue ought to see the writing on the wall and get on board with that.
Well, I think he does see that. I mean, look, he's from Georgia. Our number one export is agricultural products. So certainly he is not going to do something that goes against the economic stability of the state. He believes in
that. Well, let me say, there's a big lobby. It's called Big Food.
But he believes,
and they lobby the hell out of it.
He believes in people having freedom of choice and parents having freedom of choice about what their children eat.
But it is kind of interesting, Nan, that State Agriculture Commissioner Gary Black has a program specifically devoted to to making sure that Georgia schools are serving Georgia products.
That's right, and it's smart.
Farm products.
It's smart. It's smart. He has worked with our farm to school movement around the state. The Ag Department got on board with having food stamp recipients be able to use their food stamps at farmers markets selling fresh produce and get their dollar match dollar for dollar. So there's lots of exciting innovation going on in Georgia. I think that this is a backward step catering to the salt-filled food.
Instead of legislating decisions about what one eats, there has to be some faith and confidence in our persuasive ability to educate people about making good choices. So as a conservative who believes in liberty, then we're choosing to make sure that people are educated about their choices, which we need to do a better job of that. Being educated about choices than having choices in front of
them. We're spending public tax dollars on food for our children and our massive public education system.
Right,
should we not spend those tax dollars wisely?
All right. Let me weigh in.
Yeah.
I want data. Sonny Perdue argues that children are not going to eat foods they don't like. Nan Oreck says that's ridiculous. She cites the school in her community that's growing food on the. Where's the data? Where's the data? We know
we'll bring it. Yeah, we got the data.
The School Nutrition Association, and I don't know who's behind them, but there are nutritionists that work in the schools that want more flexibility.
Yeah, the group that Sonny was speaking in front of was not thrilled with Michelle Obama's program,
right.
and those new requirements. They were in favor of more relaxed approach.
Hey, Tamar, when a Secretary Perdue does something like this, do you have a sense at all of what's his stature like up there on the Hill? Are the Republicans thinking, wow, this guy's carrying a big stick, we like what he's doing? What do you sense about that?
People love him. but it's for a very specific reason. I mean, the Georgia people love him because they know him. The Republicans love him because he's a Trump appointee. But when you talk about the big constituencies that he's dealing with, the House and Senate Agriculture Committees, they love him because they have to work with him a lot next year when they do the new farm bill. They want an ally. They need an ally. And so, you know, not only that, but he came very highly recommended from Ag Group was going through. So he's very much beloved so far.
Right. And look, Sonny Perdue makes very good first impressions.
Bring it, Galloway.
Well, what I'm saying is that he, as you get to know him, he becomes a little bit more confrontational.
Jim, if ever you should introduce me in front of a group, I would appreciate it if you not say, Bill Nigut, he makes good first impressions. That's a really interesting compliment. But you're right. Greg Bluestein pointed out, because Greg covered that thing, that he continues to be sort of jovial and spiky all at the same time. And we all know who covered him that's really true about Sonny. Let's talk about another Sonny Perdue thing, Jim. He weighed in on what state issue, for goodness sake, medical marijuana.
Medical marijuana.
I thought that guys like Perdue up there in Washington didn't want to have the federal government interfere with the state's right to do what it needs to do.
Oh, no, that's Leo's shtick there. Essentially, what Sonny did was he took up the Jeff Sessions position.
Right.
There's a sweet one.
If it's against federal law, it's against federal law.
Right.
And basically, what Georgia's got a situation where it's got some laws on the book now where if you possess medicinal marijuana, the state will not prosecute you, but you can't grow it. And that's the next big step that Alan Peake, the state representative from Macon, has been pushing.
Absolutely.
And what's interesting here is that, of course, Sonny Perdue is from that same middle Georgia community.
Yeah, where Alan Peake is, that's exactly
and
right.
Sticking, and sticking from a legal position, Sonny Perdue may be keeping himself above the fray so he doesn't have to argue with the divided Republican assembly here
in
Georgia.
As long as we're talking about the imprint of Georgians on national policy in Washington, tomorrow, Senator David Perdue, he started talking about this. He got involved with this some time ago, early this year, and continues to be pushing. We all know that most people like Perdue and the Hill are opposed to undocumented immigration. Perdue is now very heavily involved in cutting back on legal immigration, right?
Yes, sir. So he came out with a bill back in February that over a decade would have the number of legal immigrants coming into the country. And now the news coming from the White House this week is that the president's been working with David Perdue and Senator Cotton from Arkansas on an even broader package.
And it's I think the name's Steve Miller and Steve Bannon.
Yes.
Are also involved in the creation of this bill. I will tell you what, this is going to be a very, very fierce debate within the Republican community, because you have one sector of the Republican Party believing that the more people you bring in, the lower wages are, and of course there's the ethnic issue. But then you have some the business-oriented Republican point of view, which says that if you need to bring in immigrants, skilled or not skilled, simply for the vitality they bring to the economy. And that's been our history.
That's right. And you talk to people that run restaurants in Georgia. Talk to the Restaurant Association. I have a restaurant owner in my district, a very popular restaurant. He's expanded to a second one. He's built out and has a big loan from the bank and has almost 200 employees. And he says, do people not understand who in the restaurants of Georgia preparing the food, cutting the vegetables, making it nice to go out to a restaurant and enjoy a meal with your family? He says, you advertise for restaurant help, you get immigrant applicants.
David Perdue, like many Republicans, are very much pro-business. They are not going to do things, I don't think, that will have a large implication to a business being able to be viable. They're going to make sure that. What they're asking, though, is having an open door policy, even to legal immigration, without standards as to who's coming.
Well, Leah, do you really want to say that to even Republican farmers in South Georgia?
That's right. Who's going to pick those Vidalia onions?
Well, again, where's the data that there's nobody to pick it? And so, I mean,
well, we had a real live example when the study at Georgia, over at the University of Georgia, showed that our agricultural economy took a hit around $800 million. By losing half of a growing season when they passed an anti-immigrant bill here in the state. Now that's not my data. That's coming from the University of Georgia. Those are studies, and I know senators who were taken out in the fields and watched to see the squash rotting in the field. This guy says, I need 120 people picking when my crops are coming in. He says, you know how many I've got? I've got 20. Look out here at my squash. He said, what the hell are you all doing up in Atlanta? Now that's not made up. I went down, I talked to people that run cotton gins, people that run dairies in South Georgia, which are really run like factories now. They milk 24 hours a day, and they're saying, what are you all thinking? Who do you think's doing
all right,
this work?
Galloway.
Okay, well, what Mr. Trump and David Perdue and Tom Cotton are talking about is they want to cut immigration in half, and they want to emphasize high-skilled immigrants coming in. And again, that gets at the heart of what this country's been all about, because we talk about entrepreneurship here, and we worship entrepreneurship here in America, and it's those second generation of low skilled immigrants actually produce that.
All right, I want to, before we get completely away from this subject, at least if the argument partly is you reduce green card immigration so you can provide more jobs for Americans,
right.
I'm going to make a transition based on that. We know that President Trump, Leo, is going to put everybody back to work. It's been a campaign promise of his from the very beginnings of his efforts, and he talks about it all the time, putting people back to work. The argument against him has been, it's not that there aren't it's not that industry is not able to employ people. It's not as if they're failing and therefore can't put workers in jobs. It's that automation has replaced many, many
That's
jobs.
Right.
And to emphasize that, Ball State University in Indiana released a report the beginning of this week that I thought was really significant. It looked across the country and said that because of automation, there are going to be many, many American counties that are going to have human jobs replaced by automation. And Jim, Georgia had probably, I don't have it in front of me, unfortunately, 10 or 12 counties on that list, including places like Dalton, Georgia, the carpet industry, which is more and more automated. And that's the real problem that President Trump and
right.
his economic team are facing.
Right, right. And especially down in South Georgia,
yeah.
where you have, like Nan said, you have agricultural becoming factory work, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's look, you've got tractors being driven, automated tractors on the way here.
But isn't that an argument for changing green card evaluations to encourage high-skilled labor?
Oh, my God. Who is going to change the beds in the hotels? Who the hell is going to change the beds?
All right,
if you go into these major hotels, I've been to Vegas. You look at the workforce in Vegas. Massive. Massive.
Okay.
We've litigated this for the time being.
But I will say that what we have in the United States now is a low birth rate country.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody's going to have to pay the Social Security for the baby boomers as they get up past 90.
All right. We got to get in a break. We know people have been talking all week about President Trump, about Donald Trump Jr., and the meeting with the Russians. But we saved that for last because we, as often as possible, want to make sure you hear about this state and the people who represent the state. But certainly there's a lot to dig into about the Trump White House this week. And we'll talk about some late developments when we come back from a break.
In the novel Beautiful Animals, two rich young women while away the days on a Greek island until a mysterious stranger washes ashore.
I didn't want to have some political program with having a Syrian refugee. But it was perhaps an opportune moment to explore this phenomenon that has arrived in the last two or three years.
Novelist Lawrence Osborne this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 to 7 on GPB.
I'm Russ Bell and Vice President of Broadway in Atlanta. Broadway in Atlanta is the premier presenter of national touring Broadway, and we host over 250,000 guests annually at the Fox Theater. Broadway in Atlanta underwrites with GPB because we are big supporters of the arts, and we believe the listeners of GPB do as well. Subscribers will come up and thank us for supporting the local GPB station.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Ben Andrews tweets, Nan Orrick is fired up and completely right on Political Rewind today. You think, Ben? Kathleen Pendleton is in your corner, too, Nan. She thinks you've made all the points. But we have people who are concerned. We have Ted Barfield tweets us frequently, and he points out that there may be other ways to pay for some of the things that could be lost in terms of funding for insurance for most people. One of the things is the elimination of the deductibility of employer-provided insurance, and that has been batted around, but boy, that's a tough one to sell, isn't it?
Huge, huge.
All right.
You know, and we can't leave this segment without pointing out that all the other industrialized nations, the developed nations of the world, have universal health care. And when our folks go over there and stub a toe or break an arm, they just come back talking in glowing terms about, you know, they took me in, and that's... Everybody's doing it but us.
Okay. All right. Time to turn to President Trump. We all know he's in Paris, hence producer Lisa Clark choosing the French-themed music at the beginning of our show, the Marseille. He, of course, had a news conference with President Macron yesterday, and you knew it was going to happen. He was asked about the meeting that Donald Trump Jr. took with a woman who allegedly had ties to the Russian government. And here, you've heard much of this, but here's to remind you some of what he said.
A it's called opposition research or even research into your opponent. I've had many people, I have only been in politics for 2 years, but I've had many people call up, oh, gee, we have information on this factor or this person or, frankly, Hillary. That's very standard in politics. Politics is not the nicest business in the world, but it's very standard where they have information and you take the information. And honestly, I think the press made a very big deal over something that really a lot of people would do.
Tamara, is this sucking all the oxygen out of everything else up there right now?
I don't know. I would say at least in, you know, on Capitol Hill, people have been pretty focused on health care. The Republicans would rather talk about that than the Russia stuff.
Well, I get that they don't want to talk about it, certainly with you guys, you reporters up there. But how do they feel they're going to get anything done as long as the president is seems so consumed still with Russia?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of frustration when you do ask Republicans that question. And health care for a lot of moderates is something that they're kind of scared to talk about right now. But they'd even rather talk about health care than Russia. So.
Leo?
Well, I mean, I don't think the president's consumed with talking about Russia. I think the media is consumed with talking about Russia. And we've got all these things like health care and other legislative reforms that we need to be dealing with.
My.
Jim?
Well, it's the tweeting. It's the 6 a.m. setting of the media agenda with your Twitter feed. And it's, we wrestle with that every day. And every day, President Trump keeps bringing us back to it. And he's, I got to say, he's the one that's bringing up Russia more than anybody else.
You know what's astonishing to me is if you go back and look at the emails that Donald Trump Jr. exchanged with in setting up with Rob Goldstone, the
right.
guy who helped set up this meeting. It almost feels as this is an attempt to lure him into a trap, but it wasn't. The one of the first ones, the Crown Prosecutor of Russia offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to her father. And, of course, that's the one where he replied, I love it.
I mean, you don't have to connect dots. It's all right in black and white.
What's illegal about that? Anything?
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about it.
But first, I will, first of all, but Bill, to your point, the email that you just read, If somebody had presented to me that to me as a script for a TV movie of the week, I'd say no. People don't talk that way. You have to be more careful about your exposition. You're laying it out right there, everything.
Let's listen. We're going to keep talking about this, but while we've got Trump in the news conference, let's listen. You know, he had some early problems with President Macron, as we know, and during the campaign, routinely had nothing but negative things to say about France. Let's listen to him yesterday.
You have a great leader now. You have a great president. You have a tough president. So I really have a feeling that you're going to have a very, very peaceful and beautiful Paris. And I'm coming back. You better do a good job, please. Otherwise, you're going to make me look very bad.
And you're always welcome.
Thank you.
You know, it's suddenly, Tamara, it's when you watch President Trump with foreign leaders and with some of the people who come to visit him in the Oval Office, it finally occurred to me that now, I really mean this in about the most neutral way I can. You may love his policies, you may love what he's trying to do for the country, but he has this habit of talking about people the way a great salesman talks about people when they mean, hey, he's the greatest guy I ever met. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everything's great and wonderful and the best. And yeah, just the way he talks, I think.
Where is this headed up there? I noticed that, the team noticed, that there's now a bill up there. Leo's up, thinks the media is obsessed, and I hear that. I think we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But there's a bill been introduced that's trying to force the White House to have at least 2 on-camera briefings a week. Clearly, that's from Democrats. That's not going anywhere, is it?
Absolutely not. No.
We also have the first stirrings of Democrats calling for impeachment. you know, this is, it strikes me, Nan, where Democrats better not get over their skis. It's a little premature to talk. And we got a tweet from one of our listeners saying, don't be talking about treason, which some people have been. We're getting a little ahead of ourselves, Nan.
Well, I was around, as were some others in this room and on the listeners, when Watergate unfolded, bit by painful bit, drip, drip, drip. And if the media had not drilled down, the truth would never have been known. It would have been, the law would have been broken, and the American people poorly served, and Nixon would have gotten away with highway robbery. He didn't, but that's because of what the media
did. But
it was
a good 2 years, I think, into mm-hmm. that investigation before
right.
before really the word impeachment began drilling down.
When you are leaning on organizations that have, by their own implosions, like CNN recently, and
what?
Even other news agencies, their own admitted use of people who weren't vetting their stories, et cetera, it is difficult to get into a situation where you want to impeach an American president based on media stories right now.
All right.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more profoundly.
Disagree. All right.
Okay. All right. But let us disagree with you. Bill, on the impeachment talk, on the treason talk, the thing you have to remember is we still have a Republican Congress.
Yes.
We have a Republican House,
yeah.
a Republican Senate. Getting out over your skis also means talking about things in terms of that just politically are not possible right now.
Right. Well, there are always those who message that are harbingers of things to come, and they're early out and they're laughed at. They laughed at the concept of fight for $15
yeah.
minimum wage. Well, guess what? We put that in our city budget now. But there were the early birds were vilified for that and called crazy and out of their mind. So you always have early messengers. And frankly, I heard an interesting thing around there are those who are looking at the speed at which Republicans backed off from Nixon and when they finally said, this is it, we're not behind you anymore, and predicting that as the election cycles run, we will see that with the Republicans.
All right, so here's where I think, Jim, tomorrow we've all covered a lot of campaigns. And one of the things that we have watched in campaigns is when a candidate on one side gets into deep, deep trouble, the smart way in which the other side deals with that is to keep their mouth shut and let the person who's facing significant trouble keep digging the hole himself.
Nope.
And this is what Democrats are failing to do
right
now.
There are individual Democrats who have their own politics right. and who call for or don't call for an impeachment
strategy.
Let
me get Jim in here on that, too.
Yeah, yeah. When a guy's got a shovel in his hand, you leave him alone.
Yeah. All right.
dig.
All right. I want to go back to the state for just a couple of minutes because there's a story we don't want to miss. Jim, Republican gubernatorial candidate Michael Williams, who was the first elected official in the legislature to support President Trump, called a news conference yesterday to blow the whistle on Casey Cagle. You were there.
Yeah. He said he was going to expose the, quote, reprehensible actions of the lieutenant governor and more important, provide evidence and corroboration.
Yeah. And you're writing a column about this for Sunday. We want to give people.
Yeah. Basically, what he is trying to do, he's trying to bring Donald Trump tactics into Georgia, where you rely on exaggeration, innuendo, and not a whole lot of evidence.
Let's listen to two things. We'll listen first to him lay out his thesis yesterday.
I've always advocated that politics should remain focused on the issues rather than the individuals. However, it has become unavoidable to ignore the character of someone who seeks the highest office in our state.
All right. So he was going to deliver the goods, right?
A good businessman he is. A Donald Trump he's not.
All right. Jim, you were there.
He delivered no goods. He cast a lot of shade on people, but there wasn't one fact in there.
All right, and he did attack Cagle, saying that Cagle had killed legislation that would have given raises to police
yes.
officers. But here's the way he summed it all up.
Casey, I know you're watching this. I was told this press conference was of great interest to you, mainly because you were unsure of which of the many underhanded political games and reprehensible acts I was going to expose today. You and I both know this list is long, and I've just gotten started. Do the people of Georgia a favor. Drop out of this race.
So are these, I'm going to give, go around. Each of you can weigh in on this. Are these tactics going to work? Are these Trump-like tactics going to work in a statewide election?
We're talking about it.
Okay. So you think it brings attention to it.
If his goal was to get a press conference, he got one, and people are talking about it days later.
Tamara, does this stuff work in a local, what I call a local by that statewide election in the way it might on a national stage?
I mean, we've seen a few candidates in the last cycle, kind of Trump-esque candidates, try and do similar things on the local level and the state level. It hasn't worked so far because nobody can match the money, the fame that he had going into it, the exact personality. Who knows? I mean, right now it's showed so far that it doesn't work.
Yeah, Michael Williams is not Donald Trump. And I caught one of our senators, Brandon Beach, who said, Georgia is not a D.C. swamp. It's got its own alligators and its own problems, state capital is a fairly cozy place, and you don't get a lot done by burning bridges, and if this guy really wants to be governor, that was a really poor start.
All right. Your column will tell us more about that. We are almost out of time. It's Friday, which means we want to do a quick segment on what we missed this week. Nanork, this is, I think I mentioned this to you, especially based on some of the things you've been saying in the show today, which have been perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
The editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review published a piece a couple weeks ago that we've been meaning to talk about. And here's what he said. He said, remember when we used to obsess about every presidential tweet, when every story was about us, when Donald Trump's war with the media was really the only thing that mattered? We need to stop. Stop reporting on every tweet with the volume of a declaration of war. Stop letting the president and his staff frame every misstep and scandal as a media story. Stop treating Trump's war with the press as if it's the most important thing happening in the country. It's not. He is arguing it's time for us to cover the news and stop encouraging this war with the media. You've got a chance to weigh in very quickly.
Look, I'll go back to the MSNBC fight. Donald Trump did his tweeting stuff, and Mika Brzezinski replied with a picture of a kid's hands on a box of Cheerios. I wouldn't have done that. I think that was just that was just playing
for tiny hands.
Yes, right. But it was a shot she shouldn't have taken.
I wanted to mention it because we've been saying on this show for a while, we do not want to help make the media the story. Okay.
Well, but
you got 5 seconds.
There is a history of autocrats coming into power and stripping the media, demeaning the media, criminalizing the media.
All right. Nan Oreck, Leo Smith, Tamar Hallerman in Washington, Jim Galloway, thank you for being with us. We're back Monday at 2 with former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. Can't wait to see you then. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a great weekend.